How are we doing today? Doing all right? It's beautiful weather out there. A little cold, but beautiful nonetheless. For those of you who are new or visiting today, my name is Daniel. I'm the lead pastor here at the church, and would just love to chat with you after the church, get to know you a little bit better. So feel free to find me. I'll be somewhere around the front usually. So yeah, happy to grab a chat with you. I want to start here. 7 years ago, I bought a house in Calgary. I lived in Calgary for about 5.5 years. And when we bought our house in Calgary, I didn't get a good look at the backyard. And the reason why is because the backyard was covered in snow. And so I made all these assumptions that it was just this plain, normal backyard. And months later, on our move-in day, I was surprised at the condition of the backyard. To say the least. We moved into our house in Lake Chaparral, and I opened the back door, and to my horror, I realized that my entire yard was filled with weeds that had grown up to like knee height or thigh height, and it was just essentially all dead. The photos there are of the backyard, and that's after I pulled out all of the weeds. I filled 7 bags full of yard waste bags, and put them on the curb, and that was my backyard. I was so embarrassed that year. I'd look at my neighbors, and they'd have these perfect green lawns, and I would look at this barren wasteland that is my backyard, and my impression of Calgary at that moment was I had moved from the lush green rainforest of Vancouver Island to this post-apocalyptic wasteland that is Calgary. So I went from this, and let's go to the next slide, to this, right? Welcome to Calgary. Now, I want to say Calgary is actually a really beautiful space. The mountains are beautiful. The place actually turns green for 3 months, and then it goes snowy, and then it goes brown after the snow melts. But it is beautiful. But my yard was horrific. We couldn't even let our kids play in the yard because of all the thorns and thistles in the backyard. There were barely any patches of grass. And so when I talked to my neighbor, I later found out that the previous tenants of the house had 3 large dogs, and they were the reason why the backyard was completely killed. This is a picture, so let's go back to that photo of my barren yard. This is a picture of after all the weeds had been pulled. And today, I want to share with you the 7-day creation story, or the recreation story of my backyard, okay? So it starts like this. In the beginning was a backyard that was without form and void. It was void and desolate. And on day one of this creation story, I killed all of the weeds and pulled them all out by hand. I remember having to triple glove my hands to pull out some of these weeds and get all of their spindly roots out of the ground. And there was evening and morning the first day. On day 2 of the creation story of my backyard, I rented a rototiller and dug up the entire backyard. And then I worked at leveling the yard, taking down the high spots and bringing up the low spots, filling in the holes that the previous dogs have dug. And then there was evening and morning the second day. On day 3, I had 6 yards of topsoil dumped onto my driveway. Look at how small my kids were, hey? That's like kindergarten Rivers and Micah, okay? I had 6 yards of topsoil dumped into the front driveway because there was no back access to the backyard. And with a wheelbarrow and shovel, I had to truck loads of dirt from the front driveway to the backyard. And it took me all day. There was evening and morning the second day or the third day. And then on day 4, I raked and leveled all that new soil so that the new grass would have good soil to sink its roots deep down into, continuing to work at leveling the yard as best as I could. And yes, there was evening and morning the fourth day. And on the 5th day of my backyard creation story, I then ordered 100 rolls of sod delivered to my house, and for an entire day was carrying sod from my front yard to my backyard, working against time because on hot Calgary days, sod has to be laid down within 24 hours. And so I had this huge roller to make sure that everything was even, and there was evening and morning that day. And from day 6 onward, I then prayed for rain. I was like, Lord, I don't want my water bill to be astronomical. Could you do me a solid? And could the heavens open up and could rain pour down? And unfortunately, it did not rain, and so my water bill was sky high for those day after day of just water, 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 hoping that this grass would take root into the new soil so that the lawn would take. And when I was done, I was exhausted. I was exhausted. My entire body from head to toe, when I was laying the sod, was covered in dirt. I had lost 5 pounds in one day of labor. And some of you are like, don't worry, I gained it back really quick, like really quick. But in one day of labor, I lost 5 pounds, and I was weary, and my body ached in places that I'd never felt an ache before. And all I wanted to do was crawl into bed and sleep for like the next 24 hours. But before I passed out from sheer exhaustion, here's what I did. I sat on my deck with a cold glass of iced tea, and I just looked out in sheer delight of this new creation. Now turn with me to Genesis chapter 1. That was me on day 7 after that iced tea. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered over the surface of the watery depths, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Now jump down to chapter 2. God has created the entire world as we know it in 6 days. Last week, we talked about how Adam and Eve being made on day 6, they were made on the 6th day. And so their first day on the planet, their first day of existence on earth was actually the Sabbath for them, even though it was God's 7th day. And so in verse 31 of chapter 1, it says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the 6th day. Chapter 2, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the 7th day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the 7th day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the 7th day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God for his word. So God finished his work that he had done, and he rested. But like I said in my newsletter, what an awkward way to say it. Have you noticed that in Genesis 2? It's like if you submitted this to an English teacher, they'd be like, redundant, 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 redundant. You could just have to say it once, that he had finished the work that he had done. Look at Genesis 2, verse 2 again. "On the 7th day, God had completed his work that he had done, and he rested on the 7th day from all his work that he had done." Oftentimes, we make the assumption that God finishes all of his work on day 6, and day 7, it's like he's in bed watching Netflix because he's so exhausted. But notice the clunky language kind of makes it seem that God created something on the 7th day of creation. In fact, some Hebrew scholars suggest that the very thing that God creates on day 7 is rest. He creates rest, menucha in Hebrew. God finishes his work, looks at all that he has made, and then he rests. And listen, this isn't God dirty from head to toe, ready to collapse because he's so worn out like I was when I had to rip up and remake my backyard in Calgary. Menucha is the kind of rest like me sitting on a chair with a glass of iced tea, looking at my backyard, declaring, "Very good." That's a different kind of rest. It means rest, yes, but it also means stillness and peace. It's not just talking about getting a break or getting more sleep. Menucha is the kind of rest that reaches all the way down deep into your soul. Like David says in Psalm 23, "He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul." This is menucha. Menucha is a rest that comes from a love that is freely given, a rest of truth and sincerity, a rest in peace and tranquility and quietude and safety. The kind of rest that God is inviting each and every one of us into is the kind of rest that comes from delighting in him through all the good that he's made, appreciating all that he has accomplished and continues to accomplish. We are in a series on the practice of Sabbath, and in this series, we are simply wanting to explore Jesus' words in Matthew 11, 28. Jesus makes the invitation. He says, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am lowly and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And Jesus is calling each of us who desires to follow him to take on his yoke, to take on his set of teachings, his way of life, his understanding of what it means to be a flourishing person. And he's extending an invitation to each of us in this room, saying to each of us, are you tired yet? Are you worn out? Come to me. It seems that every book on Sabbath that I've read so far is usually written by an American theologian for an American audience. And so all the statistics in these books tend to be American statistics. And so I had to do a little bit of digging. There's not as many sort of Canadian statistics, but here's what I found. According to Benefits Canada, nearly half of Canadian employees feel overworked and burnt out. We are working longer days now. 25% of working Canadians work after the standard workday is done. So we're logging more than the 40-hour week. 4 out of 10 work on weekends. So they take their work on weekends at least once a month, at minimum. Breaks. Did you know that lunch breaks are becoming rare? 4 out of 10 Canadians eat their lunch at their desk so that they can continue working while they're eating. According to Gallup, the state of the global workplace report in 2025. So this is a global survey of 225,000 people all over the world, polling them on their work-life balance, okay? So workers were asked about their experience at their jobs, including how often they felt stressed, angry, sad, or lonely. Now, surprisingly, Canada topped the list on this workplace report in terms of stress. Isn't that surprising? 58% of Canadians responded as stressed out because of their work. Now, listen, we may have gotten silver in both men and women's hockey at the Olympics, but we crushed it in terms of workplace stress. Am I right? Huh? We beat the US by 8 percentage points on stress, you guys. We did it. We did it. We've arrived. In 2025, Canadians are feeling exhausted at rising rates, and so according to the Mental Health Research Canada survey, we've risen 4 percentage points from last year just on feelings of burnout. Apparently, most full-time working Canadians get a minimum of 2 weeks of vacation per year, but only 1 in 3 Canadians actually take their full allotted vacation. That was surprising to me. So work is paying you to take a break, and you're like, I don't have time. I don't have time to do that. In the words of A.J. Swoboda, our bodies wear ragged, our spirits thirst. We have an inability to sit still and be as we drown ourselves in 24/7 living. We seem to be able to do anything but quench our true thirst for the life of God. We have become perhaps the most emotionally exhausted, psychologically overworked, spiritually malnourished people in all history. And so today, as we continue our study on what rest for your souls is really all about, in this series, I'm using the themes that come from Marva Dawn's book on Sabbath, Keeping the Sabbath Holy, as a guide to give us a sense of what it means to actually follow Jesus into the kind of rest that he's offering us. And Marva Dawn says that there's 4 pillars to Sabbath rest. Number one, it's to cease, and that's what we're going to talk about this week. Next week, we're going to talk about what it means to actually rest. 3, to embrace, and finally, to feast. And today, as we look at a theology of ceasing and for what it means for us to actually stop, in the words of Psalm 46, verse 10, be still and know that I am God. I like the CSB translation, stop fighting and know that I'm God, exalted among the nations, exalted on the earth. Most of the time when we think about that verse, we take it into our devotional life as if we're walking in the forest and we're thinking, this is what it means to be still before the Lord. But the context of Psalm 46 is that God is actually talking to kings and rulers and nations, and he's saying, silence, stop it, stop fighting. I am God. I'm the one who will be exalted in all of the earth. God's telling the whole world to quit fighting it and to know that he's God and we are not. He's saying to kings and dignitaries and political leaders, to CEOs and presidents and nations and cities. He's saying to earthly superpowers, and he's saying to you today, quit puffing yourselves up through your accomplishments so that you might be high and lifted up, so that you could be somehow exalted in, on all of the earth. He's saying, listen, you can't even fight me on this. I'm the one who will be exalted in all the earth. So be still. Cease. Stop. Jacques Ellul once said that the Sabbath shows us that work is not, after all, so excellent or desirable a thing as people often tell us. See, we live in a culture that is obsessed with achievement, aren't we? We're steeped in an achievement culture. Achievement, in the words of Mary Bell, is the alcohol of our time. Work is our drug, our numbing agent, escape hatch, and anesthetizing behavior. Achievement makes us feel the semblance of some glow of heightened, idolized identity where we are what we do in this modern world. We become addicts to doing, making, producing, and accomplishing. Now, how do I know this? Well, there's hints of it all over the place, aren't there? For example, when you meet a stranger for the first time, what is, like, generally one of the first questions that they ask you? What do you do? This happened to me at the dog park on Friday. An older gentleman at Balaclava Park asked me, hey, do you work from home? This is Friday. What do you do? And I was like, oh no, here we go. Now I have to throw the hard pastor card down on the table. And so I looked at him and I said, I'm a minister. I pastor a small congregation down in Kitsilano. And he said, huh, wow, well, I'm Jewish. And how did you get this job? How do people become pastors? And I was like, oh, usually this is the conversation killer, right? Usually this is like, oh, look at the time. I got to take my dog home. I'm like, you just got here. They're like, no, we got to go home. The dog's tired. I have a friend named Mike. When Mike was single, he hated that dreaded question, what do you do, right? Especially when he was at parties talking with a single eligible female. And it's not because Mike was ashamed necessarily of his job, but Mike actually had this amazing career, but to explain his career to people was like the death of every conversation, a conversation killer. And so a conversation would go like this. He's at a party, he's talking to an eligible female that he's interested in finding more about, and within moments of striking a conversation, she asks the dreaded question, so Mike, what do you do for a living? And Mike, and I quote, he would be like, I spend all day producing and synthesizing proteins and enzymes. And the now no longer eligible female is like, oh, that sounds interesting. Oh, I think my phone is ringing. I gotta go. And Mike's like, I didn't hear a ring. And she's like, no, it's ringing. I gotta go. Bye. In our day and age, our doing, our striving, our accomplishing, our how cool our jobs sound, is what we use to measure our own worth, our sense of identity, and how we're doing compared to other people in our culture. In the words of Batman, it's not who you are underneath, it's what you do that defines you. Is that a good Batman? I got a war. Tom was like, that was terrible. I'm gonna keep trying right now until I get it, okay? I'm not gonna keep trying. Listen to the words of Marva Don. Too often we fail to appreciate others because they don't meet our expectation, because they are not as good as we are at certain things, or because they don't measure up to the world standards for usefulness. It seems to me that the church could take the lead in suggesting other values by which to cherish individuals. If we can give up our need to produce and to judge others similarly by their accomplishments, we can be freed to value those particular gifts that others bring into our world. Thus, our Sabbath ceasing from productivity can bring great healing into our own lives as well into the lives of those around us. It's there. A practice. Is there a practice that we can adopt from the life of Jesus that might actually recalibrate and remind our hearts that we are not what we do? You are not what you do. Our worth is not defined by our achievement. And I would contend that the practice that pulls this front and center of our consciousness is the practice of Sabbath. A.J. Swoboda again. He says, Sabbath is a scheduled weekly reminder that we are not what we do. Rather, we are who we are loved by. Sabbath and the gospel scream the same thing. We do not work to get a place where we finally get to breathe and rest. That is slavery. Rather, we rest and breathe and enjoy God that we might enter into rest. In the words again of Marva Dawn, this is what we celebrate on the Sabbath day. We join the generations of believers going all the way back to God's people, the Israelites, who set aside a day to remember that we are precious and honored in God's sight and loved, profoundly loved, and it's not because of what we can produce. Like I said last week, Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day, and so their very first day of existence on the planet is God's seventh day. Their first day of existence is not a day of work. Work comes later in their story. Their first day of existence is a day of ceasing. It's a day of rest. Their first obligation in life is to enjoy God and to delight in all that he has made. A day of delight and enjoyment, a rest in all that God has accomplished for them. Now check this out. What's the first thing? Let me ask you this question. What's the first thing that is declared to be holy in the scriptures? It's the Sabbath. The Hebrew word for holy is kadosh. Isn't it interesting that God doesn't declare the earth to be holy? He doesn't declare the land or the mountains or the stars or animals or even people. None of it is declared holy in the creation account. The first mention of anything in all creation being declared holy is the Sabbath. Isn't that interesting? It's a day that is declared holy. To be more precise, God declares time to be holy, not space. This is important because if you were an ancient person reading all the different creation accounts out there, like if you were Sumerian or Egyptian or Phoenician, you would naturally expect the gods to declare a space to be holy, like making a holy mountain or creating a temple in the honor of the gods and dedicating that space as holy. And we even see this concept in the scriptures when the Israelites construct the tabernacle. They set apart a space that is dedicated for the presence of God and it's declared as holy. But in the creation story, it's fascinating that the first thing that the God of the universe declares as holy is not a place or a person or a being or a space. It's a day. It's a time. It's time. In other words, the first thing he sanctifies is time. Now, why is this important? It's important because in Christian circles, we tend to focus in on the notion of God's presence residing in spaces. We say this when revival and renewal breaks out. And this actually happens, right? God does come and visit spaces and regions, like the revival that happened in the Hebrides in Scotland in 1949 to 1952. There are actually testimonies of the Hebridean revival where God's manifest presence was so thick in this area that even sailors sailing off of the coasts of the Hebrides would feel the presence of God moving and be moved to repentance on their boats. And I want to say, that is amazing. And may it be that people who walk by our church building would be caught up in the presence of the Lord because the presence of the Lord manifests with such thickness in this space. But in John 4, Jesus has a conversation with a Samaritan woman who's living out of the conviction that God's presence is relegated to spaces and places. She says to Jesus, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews say that the place to worship is in Jerusalem. What is that about? That's about God's presence inhabiting spaces and places. Jesus told her, believe me, woman, an hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. An hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And though this conversation, yes, is more about how the kind of worship that pleases God is one that comes from our spirit, meaning that worship must be genuine and sincere and from the heart, but it also must be anchored in the truth, meaning that it must be rooted in the truth of who God is and what he's like as revealed to us in the person of Jesus and the scriptures. But this conversation also points out, it reminds us again that God's presence isn't only confined to spaces and places that we've dedicated for him. By God declaring time to be holy in Genesis, it's a reminder that God's presence can be found in the consecration of time. God's presence inhabits time as well as space. And so the question is, what rhythms and practices do you keep where you are consecrating time to stop, to cease, and be in the presence of God? What rhythms and practices do you keep where you hear the voice of the Father remind you, like he reminds kings and nations, to stop your striving, stop your doing, stop your need to achieve, and be still and know that he's the one who's God? What practices do you keep where the frenetic and hectic schedule is set aside and you cease? Corrie ten Boom once said, if the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. Yeah. Why? Because either way, your soul will shrivel. The reason why busyness is similar to sinfulness is this. If you're a Christian, your sin does not break your relationship with God. It's not like you sin and now you're out and going to hell. No, our sins have been paid for by the blood of Jesus. But here's the thing about sin. Sin greatly hinders our fellowship and our awareness with God, our communion with him, our ability to have a sense of his abiding presence. Busyness does the exact same thing. When we are busy, when we are overloaded, when we are stressed out, it is rare that we have a heightened awareness of the present needs of others, let alone an acute awareness of the presence of God in our lives. And I think this is why God appears to Elijah with a whisper in 1 Kings 19. Do you know this story? Elijah has had this crazy showdown with the prophets of Baal. And now he's on the run for his life because Jezebel is after him and he thinks he's going to die like all the other prophets. And in verse 9, it says, there he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And he said, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Do you see it in this story? It's in the stillness, isn't it? It's in the ceasing. It's in the whisper that God meets Elijah. The discipline of ceasing, of stopping, of taking a real rest is not just for your own emotional and physical health. It's for your soul to find rest in him. It's in the ceasing where we cultivate an awareness of the presence of God. Now, how many of you want a greater awareness of God's presence in your life? How many of you? Let me tell you, your awareness of God's active presence rarely happens when your schedules are slammed full, going from one thing to the next. Rarely happens. Perhaps you haven't been hearing from the Lord simply because you're too busy. You're too overloaded. And it's going to be in you setting apart time to stop, to cease, to simply be with him. I think God whispers to his friends because when you yell at someone, it's like warning everyone to stay back. But a whisper is an invitation to come in real close. When do you actually have time in your week to stop, to cease, to stop your striving, to stop your producing, to stop your making, to stop trusting in your production, all the things that we do to tell ourselves and prove to others that we matter and that we're important? Quit your striving, quit your incessant need to produce so that you can make something of yourself and now be still and know. I know that he's God. This is why Sabbath is important. Ceasing reminds us that who we are is not because of our own hands, our own feet, and our own blood, our own sweat, and our own tears. Who we are is because of the hands and feet of Jesus pierced for us. Who we are is because of his blood, his sweat, his tears poured out for us. Now, what does this mean practically, right? Because I know there's practical people, and you're like, this is great, I'm on board, but what does that actually look like? Can I get a witness on that? Some of you are like, I get weekends off. Isn't that Sabbath by default? How many of you get 2 days off a week? So how many of you are retired? You're like, every day is weekend, right? I don't even know what day it is. Eugene Peterson once called a day off, you know what he called it? He called it a bastard Sabbath. The illegitimate child of the Sabbath. And in the following weeks, I'm going to attempt to be as practical as I can be on what practicing the Sabbath in the Spirit of Jesus could look like in 2026. But here's the thing. On most of our days off, we use them to simply catch up on all the work we were unable to finish in the week. We use our weekends to catch up on emails, to pay bills, to fold endless laundry, to grocery shop, to cut grass, to prune the garden. And the off chance we don't have anything to do and we don't feel like we have anything to do, we often fall into the vortex of escapisms. Anyone? I'm the only one? Okay, all right, thank you. So we binge watch Netflix, anyone? I'm told that the average Netflix series is finished in 4 days, and I know there's individuals saying, 4 days? That's weak. 2 days, right? Some of you are like, 2 days? One night. You got to get it done. Anyone? We fall into the vortex of video games. We sit down and relax and doom scroll. We get caught up in the unending loop of Instagram reels. Anyone ever get caught up in Instagram reels and then you're like, it's 2 a.m. and I went to bed at 10. How did that happen? How many of you, after a weekend of all of that, feel refreshed on Monday morning, ready to go into work? Let me ask you another question. How many of you, after binge watching an entire season in one night, feel totally refreshed at the level of your soul? Anyone here? You're like, I watched the entire season of The Pit in one night. That's like 15 hours. And I basically came out the other side like a doctor, but I'm exhausted, right? Anyone here? We confuse relaxation with restoration all the time. Those two things are not the same. Listen, what's crazy is that our attempts, even at relaxation, sometimes actually bring us more stress. Have you noticed that? So how many of you have ever watched the news and you're watching horrible news about cartels being toppled in Mexico and you're just like, oh my goodness, this world is crazy right now. And so you're like, I just need to relax from all the heaviness of the world. And so you turn on your gaming console and you put on Call of Duty. Anyone? That's medicating your descent with an even further descent, right? That's like trying to fix your stress by entering into deeper stress. This is why having a day off or even 2 days off is not actually the Sabbath. It's not the same. Most of our days off, when we're not doing other work, is simply an attempt to escape the pressures of your ordinary life, to neglect the care of your body, to the neglect of the care of your body, your mind, your emotions, what we call the soul, and to squander what little energy you have left on things that don't actually restore you at the level of your soul. How many of you, when you go on vacation, when people ask you, how was your vacation? You say, I need a vacation from my vacation. Anyone ever say that? Yes. Now, in the weeks to come, we're gonna talk about how in Jesus' day, the Pharisees were making the Sabbath another burden to throw upon people. And so we'll be discussing what Jesus means when he says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. But here's a couple of things I want to leave you with when it comes to Sabbathing well. Let me read you Genesis 2, 1-3 one more time. So the heavens and the earth and everything in them were completed. On the seventh day, God had completed his work that he had done, and he rested. On the seventh day, from all his work that he had done, he blessed the seventh day and declared it holy, for on it he rested from all his work of creation. According to the Bible, it is about more than just, like taking a rest is about more than just taking a day off. After creating the world, God looked around and he looked at everything that he made and he declared, very good. He declared it very good. God did not just cease from his labor. He stopped and enjoyed what he had made. What does this mean for us? We need to stop to enjoy God, to enjoy his creation, to enjoy the fruits of his labor and our co-laboring with him. The whole point of Sabbath is joy in all the things that God has accomplished. And as much as some of you want me to do it, I'm not going to do it. Some of you want me to spell out, okay, so Daniel, just spell out clearly what is work and what is Sabbath rest. Give us the list of do this on Sabbath, don't do this on Sabbath. And here's why it won't work. So for example, some people feel absolutely refreshed and rested when they're in the garden. Any gardeners here? Fresh and rested in the gardens, pulling weeds and growing plants. It's nourishing to your soul. Every time I garden, I just remember my backyard in Calgary. It's trauma-inducing for me. So instead of telling you how you should Sabbath in a prescriptive way, here's some brilliant principles from Tim Keller to help you consider how to take a real rest. Number one, take time for sheer inactivity. Take some time to actually cease from all activity and all exertion. This pause in the work-life cycle is analogous to Israel's practicing of letting a field lie fallow every seventh year to produce whatever it happened to grow that year. You know, they had these rules, right? So God says in Leviticus 25 that the soil on the seventh year is to rest. Don't plant anything in it, so that you give it rest for its nutrients to not be depleted. Because if you keep planting in the same field over and over and over again, the soil depletes of its nutrients. And so let it rest and let come up whatever comes up. I love that principle. You and I need unscheduled time, like every week, to sit in unplanned and unstructured time to let whatever needs to come up from deep within your hearts and minds to come up. This is why ceasing is actually so important. Many of us are so busy and we're running so fast that we have not let our emotions catch up to us for a very, very long time. Have you ever been in the space of stillness only to discover that in that stillness, the stillness, that you get this uncomfortable gift? It's uncomfortable because suddenly you realize, I'm not actually doing okay. It's only in the ceasing that those things start to come up. As a side note, we are living in a time with the rise of experimentation with psychedelics as a form of therapy. Are you familiar with this? The use of psilocybin, the psychoactive ingredient in magic mushrooms, or even MDMA or ketamine, or even going down south and taking part in ayahuasca ceremonies. They're all being used to treat a range of mental health conditions, such as depression, anxiety, and addictions. And maybe part of the reason for such drastic measures in our modern culture, why we're taking such drastic measures, is because as humans, we're refusing to live under the boundaries and the rhythm that God designed for our flourishing. So if you look at the seasons of creation, for example, there's preparation seasons, sowing seasons, growing seasons, harvesting seasons, and resting seasons. There's a sacred rhythm to how this whole world operates, how God designed it to operate. And if you go against the grain of the universe, you will get splinters. If you push and push against the boundaries that God has lovingly placed upon us as individuals, things start to go awry, both for the earth and for you. And I think we're so untethered from our inner lives as modern individuals. Many in our world refuse to live under the wisdom of loving boundaries that God has placed upon us for our own souls flourishing and thriving. That we're now experimenting with powerful psychoactive amplifiers in a desperate attempt to force open the doors, those suppressed emotions, that trauma, that hurt, the failures that have been shut up for so long, and we just don't stop, and so we need harder and harder things to open those doors. And I don't think that kind of therapy in the long run will produce rest and flourishing for the human soul. The things that we're so desperately longing for in our culture. We live in this unending cycle of achievement and production and the quest for glory and the quest to make a name for ourselves. When do you have time to really cease and be a divine nobody? What are those spaces where you're just a divine nobody? To actually stop and let whatever bubble up to the surface actually bubble up to the surface. This is why ceasing is really important for your soul's flourishing. Number two, take some time for avocational activity. These are activities that energize you. Hobbies and sports, crafts, music, and yes, I will say begrudgingly, even gardening. Yeah. To keep the agrarian metaphor going, your soul is the field. So what different crop is planted in your field on the Sabbath
for the purpose of replenishing the nutrients in the soil to make it more fertile for the normal crop that it usually yields. So, three things. Take time on your Sabbath for contemplative rest. Every Sabbath, take time for contemplative rest. What brings you into a greater awareness of God's love and delight of you? This is why integrating a rhythm of worship is part of our Sabbath, as part of your Sabbath is necessary. Reading the scriptures and praying, being part of a local community of believers. Listen, that's not legalism, that's discipleship. That's designed for the formation and flourishing of your soul. But also, these are all the means that we give ourselves to keep us tethered to God's love and delight of us in Jesus. Number two, spend time having recreational rest. What activities really refresh your soul? Is it physical? Is it the physical exertion of a long hike on the Sabbath that actually refreshes your soul? For some, yeah, absolutely. Is it spending time with close friends? Is it going for dinner with like your closest friends? Is it going for that long, relaxing bike ride? Have you ever noticed those internal battles where you're like, I need to go to the gym, or I want to go for a run, but it's raining, and you have that internal fight, and you're like, I don't want to go, but then you force yourself to go, and you're so glad that you did, because there's this like nourishing and flourishing that you experience afterwards? Yeah, do those things. What activities really refresh and rejuvenate you? Number three, include aesthetic rest. What works of God's creation refresh and energize you that you find beauty in? This is where nature, art, drama, music, visual art all come in. See, God looked out at his world that he had made, and he said, very good. So aesthetic rest is necessary for participating in a good Sabbath. So let's take a moment right now. Let's not rush past as I close. Let's just stop now, right now. Maybe you need to breathe deeply. Take a moment to cease. So, Father, for every one of my friends this week, I pray that you would find them in the space of the ceasing, in the slowing and in the stopping. As we slow down from our frenetic paces and we sit as divine nobodies, God, would you meet with us and confirm to us again just how loved we are, how accepted we are in Jesus, how forgiven we are because of your Son, how approved of we are because of grace. Help us to rest in our salvation. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.